This is Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell, awakening the world to the power of God's Word. And now here is your host, Dr. William Campbell.
Welcome to Beyond Words, where we seek to move beyond talking about Scripture to living it. There are times indeed for our lives and even for entire nations when everything we thought was stable seems to disappear under our feet. How are we to handle such trying times in our lives? Our guest today, Vin Chung, will bring us insights based on his incredible journey as a refugee fleeing Vietnam in June of 1979. The story is found in his book, Where the Wind Leads, and it will keep you riveted to your seat. The story also will fill your heart with thanksgiving for the country you call home and the people you call family. Vin graduated from Harvard Medical School. He's a medical doctor, and he also holds a master's of theology from University of Edinburgh. So he has a real love for God, and he shows it not only through his practice, but through his life. He serves on the board of World Vision, and he and his wife Leslie have four children. They run their own private medical practice in Colorado Springs. And Vin, we're glad you could be with us over the phone lines. You're in Colorado now, is that right?
That's correct. Thank you so much for having me, Bill. It really is a pleasure.
The story is just incredible. And as we're just off of July 4th, it's a great time to think about what we have here, the liberties in this country, and how you took a journey from a place that you called home to come here to America, and how your life changed in the process. Vin, let's go back to the early days. You grew up in a land called South Vietnam. What was it like before you all fled? I know a lot can be said. I enjoyed reading your book. I was up until like 3 a.m. reading. It was just a great read. But so much can be said about Vietnam, and there's so much interest in our country because of the history there. But start us out with a story. Kind of paint a little picture of what it was like growing up.
So I'll take you back before the Vietnam War, and it's a story of three generations, starting with my father and his parents. They were very poor, and over the years, just from hard work and sacrifice, they built up a rice milling empire in the Mekong Delta or southern Vietnam that was worth millions of dollars. And things are going great. They're living the good life. But then after the fall of Saigon in 1975, when the communists took over, they lost literally everything. All of our property was confiscated, our vehicles, all the money, anything of value. We were actually evicted from our own house in South Vietnam and forced to live on this little farm where we had to eke out an existence from just whatever we can grow on this little farm. And so it was at this point that my parents looked at their children, there were 8 of us at this point, and saw that if we stayed there, we could still survive, but there's no future. There's no future, there's no opportunities for education, there's no freedom of thought, and they don't have, and so my parents saw that the only way for their children to have a future is to risk everything and to go out as boat people, where we got in these little rickety boats and left the country.
So, Vin, you were 3 and a half at the time, is that right?
That's correct. I was 3 and a half, and so this book is written using memories from my parents and my older siblings as well. I remember very little about the journey. I remember very just sensory memories, taste and sounds. But my parents and my siblings remember it as if it were yesterday.
Mm. And it's interesting that your father and your incredible grandmother developed and ran, just built from the ground up, this huge multi-million-dollar factory. And all of that had to be given up. What could you guys take with you when you fled the country?
So in order to leave the country, we had to pay the government a fee. And then we also had to purchase the boat and arrange for the departure. And whatever we had behind, we actually had to convert into jewelry or gold and actually smuggle it because the communist government would not allow us to bring any more than a certain amount of money leaving the country. So literally, we did not have anything but what was on our backs. We were also crammed in a boat, so there just wasn't space to bring luggage either. But that was just whatever we could carry in our clothes. That was what we left with.
You got out into the waters, and you soon met with pirates from Thailand. Tell us about the pirates.
We knew when we left Vietnam that hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese boat people had died, either at sea, which they just drowned, or they were attacked by pirates. And these were vicious pirates. Some of them are amateurs. Some of them are professionals with large, powerful boats that just rammed the boats. They came in and they did as they wish. When we encountered the pirates, my mother talked about how she would try to protect her eight children, huddling with us, trying to protect us. But at the same time, what's going through her mind was that she's afraid that she'd be attacked or raped, because that was also a very common occurrence out at the sea where there was no law.
And so you did meet with pirates pretty early on, is that right? And did they threaten you and the people on the boat?
Yes, so the pirates that we met were a group of young kids. They swarmed the boat. They ran around the decks, grabbing jewelry off of people's ears and off their fingers, ripping things out of their clothes. It was a very scary moment, and looking back, you know, when we think about it, it was that much more scary for my parents, and it's not because, and the other parents, it's not because they can't fight these pirates back, but it's because they had so many young children on the boat, and so they were essentially helpless and held hostage to that situation.
Vin, I love the picture you give in the book of your grandmother, that stalwart, that leader of the family. And I can picture her there in the boat as the pirates come. She's sitting on her wicker chair like the chief over over everybody on that sailing vessel. Describe her, and with that, give people here in the West a little sense. It's fascinating to learn more from your book about the kind of authority given based on age in that culture.
Yes, yeah, so one of the things that I have always understood growing up was the respect for elders. And in the book, I explored this a little bit more and actually talked about ancestral worship in this culture where not only do we respect adults and especially our parents, but when they die, we actually, in a way, worship them. And so that's the context of the background that I grew up in. And so my grandmother, who's my father's mother, was a widow with six children when she was in her 40s. And she had she had nothing left behind for her. She had to, and back in those days, there weren't many opportunities for women. There were also no support network. But what she decided to do was to go out and literally build it with her bare hands by grinding, by milling rice handfuls at a time to sackfuls. And she would mill it, and she'll use some to support the children. The rest she would store up and sell and continue this process until she had an empire that was worth millions of dollars. And so that was her sheer determination.
It amazed me when you described how two of her sons in their 40s would kneel before her and she would have a swatch or something to whip them with if they weren't compliant and obedient as they help run the company. I mean, we don't understand in the West, we think that's negative, but the positive side of a community in which there is family that is really connected together and where they respect the elders, that's a different world. It's hard for us to understand here in the West.
Yes, it is. I think the closest thing that we can have in the West would be analogous, you know, for example, for a child to be disrespectful towards his or her parents would be analogous to us burning the flag or burning the Bible, for example, because our parents are, you know, viewed not only with respect, but it's almost sacred. And so it's not only taboo, but almost blasphemous for any child to be disobedient to his or her parents.
Yes. Bing, reflect for a minute with me on Vietnam. It's a sad story for all of us to think about how, as American troops pulled out, the communists swept into the South and took the land over. And we may see parallels in the Middle East today as American troops pull out of Iraq and Afghanistan, and how things are changing so rapidly. Do you have any thoughts? Do you see parallels there, or is it totally different?
So absolutely. I don't have an expertise in international politics, so I can't comment intelligently on what we can or cannot do.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that at any time there is a political conflict, that women and children are the first victim.
Mm.
Just innocent bystanders who try to live in peace. But it's usually the women and the children are the first ones to suffer, and they suffer horribly. And that was what happened in Vietnam. And what also happens in these instances of instability is that there is just rampant abuse of power and corruption. And usually it's the women and children who face the brunt of it.
That's a very good answer, because it brings us to what we really need to think about, and that is the many refugees around the world, displaced peoples from war-torn countries and from places where weather has destroyed crops through famine and the like. I'm sure that what you've gone through, having experienced growing up as a refugee, really, you were born into that. It must have changed your life. It must give you a lot of compassion for others.
Absolutely, yes. And, you know, I think one, compassion, yes, because I really do understand what it's like to be poor and to live in poverty. At the same time, I also value and recognize the significance of having hope for a brighter future.
Hmm.
When I was growing up in the U.S., you know, there were 11 kids in my family. We were poor, living in the Deep South. We faced racism, prejudice. But I never lost hope of a bright future. And I think that's the difference between America and post-war Vietnam.
Hmm.
Because in Vietnam, there was no future, and that's why my parents decided to risk everything to leave. But in the U.S., growing up, I always firmly believed that, one, because of my Christian faith, that God is in control and that he holds the ultimate justice. And two, I really believe in the American dream, which is that you work hard, and there's a direct result from your hard work. And that's the beautiful thing about this country, is that whatever you put in, you get back. And I think that that's what really kept me through all those years of just studying so hard and facing social and economic challenges.
Well, let's pick it up in a boat now. You've been raided by pirates, but your lives were spared, even though they rammed into the side of the boat. It didn't sink. And on this rickety ship, you guys continue to go deeper into the ocean, heading south. And where did you land? Where did you end up?
Yeah, so the boat that we left from Vietnam had 293 refugees on it. And we survived the attack by pirates and actually made it to Malaysia. We were on the beach of Malaysia.
And what a journey that was, huh?
So when we first arrived on the beach of Malaysia, we celebrated with, oh boy, you know, this is it. But as it turned out, you know, by this time, the world has turned its backs on the fleeing refugees, the hundreds of thousands. And at this point, the refugee camp in Malaysia was closed to us.
Mm.
And not only did they say we can't, won't be admitted, but we were actually treated with brutality and hostility on the beach.
And as you were being dragged along the beach, moving, being worn out and stressed, your poor mom was in real trouble. Tell us that part of it.
That's right. So my mother, from when she left Vietnam, didn't realize that she was pregnant. But while on the beach of Malaysia, we were forced to march in unbearable heat. We were dehydrated, starved, and the conditions were so tough that she actually suffered a miscarriage and lost a set of twins. There she almost bled to death, but somehow, and I would say through the grace of God, she survived.
Well, the amazing thing, so your dad manages to get her to the hospital. He comes back to be with all of you children and the other refugees. But more than a week later, right, she comes back to find you and you're not there.
Exactly.
It was one of those miracles.
Yes, it sure is. That's the one thing that we all must know about refugees is that we are not in control of our own bodies. We have no country that wants us. We have no rights, and anybody could do to us as they wish. And my family experienced that. And even on the beach of Malaysia, my mother separated from the rest of her family. We were almost separated permanently, but it's really through a miracle that she was reunited with her family before we were then towed out to sea again.
Before we go any further, let's go back just a minute to the dream your mom had before you left Vietnam. Tell the listeners a little about that.
Yeah, so before we left Vietnam, as we were preparing, my mother had a very vivid dream. She dreamt that she was in the marketplace, and all of a sudden, everybody in the market was lying dead, including my family. But she's able to see, in this dream, and she saw that there was a man walking down the marketplace, this crowded marketplace, surrounded by people who had fallen over dead. And he would point at different people. And as he pointed at them, they would come back to life. And so she prayed and prayed, and he pointed at my family, and we came back to life. And so the interesting thing about this dream is that at this point, my mother did not know who this man was in her dream. And up to this point, while in Vietnam, my family, we were not Christians. We believe in ancestral worships. We believe in Buddhism, Taoism, and it's just a mixed variety of different superstitions. And my mother probably had heard of the name Jesus Christ, but she never really understood it. And it wasn't until much later on when she walked into the first church in Fort Smith, Arkansas. It was at a Baptist church, and she saw a picture hanging up, picture of Jesus. And that's when she said, that was the man in my dream.
Wow.
That was her experience. Wow. Yeah.
That dream in those early days before she understood all about Christ, but she had a dream, it must have carried her through in those treacherous times. So tell us, here she found you guys there finally in a beach through a miracle, and now what promises were given by the Malaysians?
That's right. So at this time, while on the beach, we weren't really told what was going on. We just knew that we had to stay on the beach, and they would corral us around a rope, and we just had to stay there and march wherever they told us to march, and then we'll just do what they told us we had to do. After several days, they then told us that our group of 290 people would then be brought to a refugee camp. And so, again, we're excited. And they put us in these four small boats. And my family was in a boat. My extended family was in another boat. These are four small, and as we find out later on, fishing boats that weren't working. And within our little fishing boat, there were 93 refugees. They told us that they would just tow us to this refugee camp. It would be a couple hours or so. But the Navy ship that towed these four boats actually towed us for over 20 hours.
Yeah.
And out in the high sea, they cut the rope and left us.
It is so brutal. It's amazing, isn't it, that your boat even survived that 20 hours of towing.
Yeah, exactly. One of the really interesting things about this book and the story of my family was that there was a BBC documentary shooting videos off of the World Vision ship during this time, and so they actually documented the rescue of my family and the 93 refugees on the boat. So after they rescued us, took us on board, they towed this fishing boat. And then it wasn't long afterwards that boat just sank. So it's really a miracle that we survived for that long on this little boat.
So you were cut to float on your own, and you tried to band together with the other boats, but you realized it wasn't going to work. You all had to cut the boats loose, and soon your boat was floating on its own?
Exactly. And so, yes, we tried to stay together, but then the boats were banging against each other, and they're afraid that it'll crack and we'll all die. And so they cut the ropes, and we were all on our own. And so at this point, my immediate family was on this boat with my mother's family. But then my father's brother and sister and his mother and all my other cousins were on different boats. And so as you learn later on that, you know, their boat drifted back to Vietnam, and my boat was picked up by World Vision.
And it's quite a difficult thing to think about, trying to survive in the open seas like that with the heat and the dehydration and all that plagued you. Tell us a little more what it was like. How many days were you stuck in the water, and how did you feel about possibility of survival?
Yeah, well, so we were drifting aimlessly for 6 days, and before we were rescued. And so imagine that we had no food, we had no water except for what rain we caught. And it was around day five when my father looked around and saw his children dying. Mm. And at this point, he just felt this need to cry out to the Creator. Now, my father, you know, he wasn't a Christian at that point. And again, he believed in ancestral worship. He believed that there are certain good virtues, such as being honest, doing good, being generous. But he really believed in a Creator, for whom he doesn't even have a name. But he cried out to the Creator and say that my children, my family is dying, and we need water. And it was almost immediately after that prayer, this gut-wrenching, visceral prayer that rain came down. And so that was his first connection with God. It was when we were drifting out in the sea. And so it's really amazing that, and again, with a little background about my father, you'll learn that when in Vietnam, when he was a very wealthy man, he was a playboy. He had a mistress. He lived a good life, according, you know, at least what was defined as a good life in Vietnam then for a wealthy man. It required that he lost everything and to be on his knees before he would reach out to God. And amazingly, God answered by bringing down rain. And that sustained us for another day before we were rescued.
And the rains came with it, a storm and the waves, and it looked like you all would be decimated by that. And then he knelt down and cried out again and prayed another time, and the people really began to believe there must be somebody listening to this guy's cries.
I know. It's pretty crazy. You know, so that was his response, and that was his experience. And, you know, during this time, too, when we're floating, drifting, you know, when we look back at the story, we say, okay, we drifted for 6 days, you know. But while you're in the moment, we didn't know how many more days it's going to be. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know if there was any help on the way. We didn't know if people were going to die in the boat. Some of the men on the boat actually became blind from dehydration. Mm-hmm. My mother was talking, you know, would describe how she was holding my twin younger brothers in her lap. They're about 18 months old at this point. And they would just continue to cry out of thirst, and they would try to leap into the water to drink it. But she was just so helpless, not able to offer them anything, and just all she could do is just hold them back so they don't jump out and drink the water.
They were like a year and a half old, those twin
That's
brothers.
Right.
It's just so such a fragile age. It's amazing they lived through that.
It sure is. It sure is. And I think now that I am a father, I can really appreciate the pain that my parents must have felt. Because I think it's one thing to suffer yourself, but to see your own children suffer must be that much worse.
So, Vin, there were hundreds of thousands of Chinese refugees coming out of Vietnam because of the border wars, and they were being ejected.
Mm-hmm.
And am I right? I think you stated that a full half of them would die on the open seas.
Yes, yes.
So, I mean, the odds of surviving must have seemed pretty nil, especially when pirates came at you again and tried to sink your boat. Describe that one.
When we left Vietnam, we knew that people were dying, and that we would never be able to get an accurate estimate of how many people tried to leave and how many people died. But the rough estimate is that it's around 50%. And we were attacked once before we made it to the beach of Malaysia. And then after we were towed out in our little fishing boat with 93 people crammed into it, the boat was cracked, the engine wasn't working, which is literally drifting aimlessly. And we encountered other Thai pirates. It's a boat, a larger boat, and that was towing a smaller boat. And they tried to flip over our boat. And, I really don't understand why anyone would do that, unless there's just some kind of evil or malice that's there. And so that right there illustrates how refugees are perceived. That it is one thing to try to rob us and get money from us, but to just try to flip over a boat just to see us die, it's just another degree of evil that I just find to be surprising for people to have against other people.
Okay, listeners, we'll be right back. The story now turns to the miraculous answers of God on the open sea.
Have you ever wanted to read the entire Bible from cover to cover? Most Christians have, and you may even be among those who have attempted it. Yet only 10% of Christians have ever read the entire Bible. B90, or Bible in 90 Days, is a Bible reading program that can help you achieve this important goal for your life and for your spiritual development. By reading only 12 pages a day, you and your friends, your Bible study group, or even your entire church can read the Bible in 90 days. To find out more about B90, visit us on the web at scriptureawakening.com and click on B90, Bible in 90 Days. Read every word that God has spoken and shared with humanity. Check it out. That's B90 at scriptureawakening.com.
Welcome back to Beyond Words. We have with us Vin Chung. He's a medical doctor, a dermatologist, lives in Colorado, but he went through an amazing journey as a youngster coming out of Vietnam. His book, Where the Wind Leads, describes this incredible story as he and his family took the dangerous journey on a small fishing boat exposed to barbaric Thai pirates, thirst and hunger, and unreceptive governments of foreign shores. But God stepped in. So, Vin, what is the chance that this little World Vision Mercy ship, I know you can't do the mathematical statistics, but give us a sense. What is the chance that this would find you all?
I think the chance is almost nil. And, you know, I have a scientific background. I'm good in math, and I'm good in logic, and that's why I love the natural sciences and being a doctor. But when you look at my story, you will see that it's a series of improbable events that at the end of the day, you really have to say God must have intervened somewhere. And I think that World Vision finding our boat is one of those events that happened.
Tell us a little bit of the World Vision story back then. Who was this guy Mooneyham? You know, what was he up to?
So Stan Mooneyham was the president of World Vision, and he first learned of the Vietnamese boat people when one of his friends showed him a photograph of this boat people family, and the woman was just in such emotional anguish at her dying daughter in front of her while they were being towed back out to sea, rejected from a refugee camp. And at that point, his heart was just broken, and he decided that he must do something about it. And so he launched Operation Sea Sweep, and together with a group of other Christians who believe that the world, you know, believe that we must do something, while the rest of the world has turned its back on the refugees, they came out to offer us assistance, and they miraculously found us.
They had been several days on the sea looking and not seeing a single refugee boat, isn't that right, as they came across north of Malaysia?
That's right, that's right. And our boat was so small, and it's just kind of drifting there, that it's really a miracle that they even spotted us.
And so they pulled up to your boat, and what did they think when they saw you all and threw the supplies down? What were they shocked?
They were shocked. Now, I'll tell you that this is one of the memories I do have, and I'll talk about what I remember when we first encountered this boat that came to rescue us. There are 93 of us crammed in this little fishing boat, probably made for five or six people, and we had been dehydrated, we've been starving, so we're near death. But I remember, and this is kind of a funny memory now that I think about it, I remember the adults yelling at everyone, lie down, lie down, lie down, telling us to lie down and look sick and desperate so that we can get some kind of compassion from this boat that showed up next to us. And looking back now, I'm thinking, we probably didn't have to try that hard to look desperate.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, but also at that point, we've been attacked by Thai pirates twice. And so when we saw this boat, we didn't know if it's going to help us or hurt us. And all we had to do was just to beg for mercy.
Mm. Your book describes as they threw out supplies, they expected you all to move quickly and make room. And everyone was so lethargic, they were completely spent. There was so little life left in each person's body. But they brought you all onto this boat. Do you remember that as a youngster?
I remember being lifted up, and I remember very little. But my older siblings remember a lot of it. Yeah, I remember that they just took care of our every need. I guess my family described they took care of our every need. They gave us water. They gave us food. They they clothed us, and then they also worked really hard to make sure that we were admitted to the Singapore refugee camp. And so by this time, you mentioned that, when they gave us food, we weren't moving around or anything. You need to realize that by this time, we're so dehydrated that my grandfather, my mother's father, was actually hallucinating by this point because he's so dehydrated. And so when this ship came up, gave us food and water, some of us probably thinking, am I imagining this or is it real? And so that might explain some of the behaviors that we have, or the lack of behavior.
Yeah, yeah. Vin, your book doesn't go into detail about, it just mentions the other boats making it to the shores of Vietnam and one barely so on an island off the shores. They had no motors. They had no sails. They were mercilessly going through the Indian Ocean. And what is your feeling? Was that the hand of God? I mean, you all, as you were taken by the mercy ship away from them, you must have felt, I know your dad felt dread, like they're lost. My family, others in his family are lost in the open sea. Was it miraculous in some measure that they all three boats would make it?
Yeah, absolutely. And, because at this, when the four little fishing boats were separated in the South China Sea, my father had no idea what happened to his mother and his brother and all those other people, and it really is a miracle that they actually did make it back to Vietnam. There was a boy who died, at least one that I know of, on the boat that my grandmother was on. But the others, as to how many of them survived, I don't know. And it really is a miracle that they did drift back to land eventually.
And we'll talk in a minute about your journey into America, but you eventually came back to visit. That must have been really hard for you to see the conditions and to see people you loved stuck back there.
Yes, absolutely. I would say it's like walking to a parallel universe. Mm. And I went back when I was a medical student. So I've gone through a lot of training. I've gotten degrees. I'm not quite finished and now on my own yet, but I still had a very bright future ahead of me. I was a student at Harvard Medical School, and then when I went back there, I saw my relatives who left with us on the same large boat from Vietnam, and they were on one of the smaller boats that drifted back. And so they had sold everything to leave their country, just like my family had. They had been attacked, they've been robbed, and when they came back to Vietnam, they were even imprisoned temporarily, and they had to beg for food and for shelter. And they've done pretty well for themselves. You know, they now have a place to live. They get clean water, and sometimes they get electricity. But while standing next to them, I saw, you know, my parallel universe. And here I am, a graduate from Harvard undergraduate already, so I already had one Harvard degree, and I'm about to graduate from Harvard Medical School. And, you know, growing up, I'd always been told that I should be so proud because I'm living the American dream, that I've accomplished so much. But while standing there next to them, I was not swollen with pride. And what I really felt was, I felt ashamed. And I think I felt ashamed because I knew that there is more that I can do. Because growing up, you know, I've always heard it preached, to whom much is given, much is expected. And, you know, that's what Jesus said. And growing up as a poor refugee kid in the deep South, you know, with the wrong skin color, I never thought that Jesus was preaching to me. You know, I thought he's talking about the rich or the powerful people. But when I was in Vietnam, I knew that it applied to me. And I realized that even though I was poor, I had a rough life and went through all the challenges and all that, but that I had been given such a special, amazing gift of being able to live in this country and to be able to have a future which I have been a part of shaping. And so at that point was when I realized, yeah, Jesus is talking about me, and so I need to do more.
We can talk about communism and be so grateful for the freedom of a republic. But one way to broach it for our listeners might be from your own family's life experience. They had this factory. They had a multi-million-dollar business running. Everyone else is running from the country. They stayed because they'd been through the many regimes, the colonialization of the French taking over South Vietnam, the North Vietnamese and their efforts, and the Americans involved with the troops, and they'd seen all these changes. They thought it was just one more typical change that would not affect commerce. Tell us a little about, you know, just reflections to help us appreciate what we have here.
Yeah, so my father, growing up, he has never experienced political peace. There was just constant turmoils, and he's seen the skirmishes between Cambodia and Vietnam. He's seen the war, and all he really wanted to do was just to live in peace. And so his family worked so hard and gave up decades of just backbreaking work. They put their blood and their tears into building this business that sustained them. And then overnight, it was just gone. That was it. There was no court that would listen to them. There was no recourse they can take. It was just taken away. And so that's the amazing thing about America, and an amazing thing that I've been able to experience, is that for my family, we know in this country, on this soil, if you work hard and you earn something, it's yours, and nobody can take that away from you. And so that's why all of my siblings have worked hard in school, and today all 11 of us have graduated from universities. We have 21 university degrees. We have 5 doctorates and 5 master's degrees, and it's because of that belief that what you put in, nobody can just take it away from you.
You know, I developed a deep respect for your father just reading the book and looking at his life, but it's also all those degrees are in large part because of him, aren't they? Talk about how that hard work and that character was carried into America. How did he make things go for you guys?
So my father, who was the formerly owner of a multimillion dollar business with several hundred employees, found himself in a country where he couldn't speak the language, didn't understand the culture, had no transferable skills. And so he took the only job that he could to support his 8 and then eventually 11 children. So he worked on an assembly line in an air conditioning plant, putting parts together to make these air conditioning units. And the funny thing about this plant that made air conditioning units was that the temperature was 100 degrees at least in the summers in Arkansas summers, and just unbearably humid.
Yeah, it's amazing. And
that's right. But he believed firmly that in this country, if you work hard, there would always be a brighter future for brighter future. And if not for him, then for his children. And he would dream when he was every day when he walked down the assembly line, he would look into the offices of the white collar workers, and these are the guys who could sit comfortably at their desk wearing a tie in a room that's air conditioned, and he would look in, standing there drenched in his own sweat, and he realized that he can't ever have that type of job, but if he would work really hard, then maybe his children would have that a job where they could sit down comfortably at the desk. And that's what motivated him, was his hope for a brighter future for his children.
It is an amazing thing to see, as you mentioned, all the degrees all the way up to the doctoral level, and his dream fulfilled in you, Vin. He always wanted a child to become a medical doctor. How all of this occurred, and I think probably for each of you children, his example of dedication and hard work that probably spurred you on, didn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that a lot of it was from what my father saw his mother did, scratching, a future with her bare hands. And then growing up, that's what I saw him do. And so I'd always held a job, and especially in college. I took the job that paid me the most money, and that was a job that involved cleaning toilets. It wasn't fun, but I just always accepted the fact that that was what needed to be done in order for me to have a brighter future. And so I stuck with cleaning toilets for 4 years in college, and then I spent many more years in medical school and residency, and today I can use my hands to do surgery to cut out skin cancers. And I think that when people think about the American dream, we all need to realize that it is still possible in this country, but it is not easy, and it's not free. And it requires a lot of sacrifices from parents, from mentors, from teachers, and then from the individual. It takes a lot of sacrifice. And I think anyone who goes through medical training would tell you that we gave up a lot of Friday nights to study instead of partying. So that's just part of what it takes to have a career that you want.
That's such a good message for us, Vin, because as you know now that you've been living here most of your life, many of us, especially in the younger generations, we tend to forget the hard work that helped to build this nation and that brought us through the wars like that in Vietnam, but especially the two world wars, and all that, the payment of people's lives to help us have the freedoms we enjoy now. We can lose it all if we forget what it costs to bring it to us, if we think of it lightly. Now, we also should think about countries where things are not so easy and think about those other refugees. I know in your book you describe how right after the war in Vietnam, as it ended, there was a wave of refugees and the American ships were ready to pick them up in the open sea and bring them safely to harbor. Then the wave of refugees diminished. But after the Chinese came under persecution, you came out with your family with a new wave, and the world at that time was looking another direction. They weren't taking it seriously. Have you seen this now, as you look at the world scene, perhaps replayed over and over as a story, where the world pays attention maybe to one hot spot, and then they kind of ignore what happens after that, and there could be many refugees in many parts of the world that we kind of turn our back on?
Yes, so absolutely. I think the term that people have used for this is compassion fatigue. And they just see so much, and after a while, people get tired. But I think that as Christians, we hear people say, let's take up your daily cross, right? And so I think it's a daily discipline to, one, always be grateful for everything that we have. And every day here, every day that I get up and I live in freedom, I am grateful for the freedom I have that was bought with blood from soldiers generations ago that I have never met. And so that's one thing I recognize. And I think we all need to recognize that.
Yes.
And then today, as a doctor, even though I have my own professional obligations to take care of my patients, and we all have jobs, we all have responsibilities, but I am always reminded of Jesus' call for us to help the poor and the needy. And these are the refugees around this world, the innocent children who cannot get clean water, or who are living in constant danger, or the women who aren't able to get education or to have some way to better their future. And so I think it's a daily reminder that we need to have. It's just a discipline. And I think that once we do it, we are individually better people. And I think I'm just a lot, I feel a lot more at peace, and I find more joy when I'm able to help others, because it's also a reminder for me of what I have.
I know, Vin, one way you're helping people is through World Vision. How did you come to serve on the board of World Vision?
Mm-hmm. Well, so I was invited by Rich Stearns, the president of World Vision, to serve. When I was invited, it's funny, I told him that I am a doctor. I'm not a pastor. I'm not a religious leader. I haven't served on boards before, but they told me that what they want is to have the perspective of a layperson. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I can offer, is one, the perspective of a layperson as someone who can help with fight poverty overseas, and is also someone with the perspective of starting out as a World Vision child to be able to be in a position now to give back.
And how did you come to write this book, Where the Wind Leads? What brought you into the place of deciding to write?
Yes. Well, so I'm not a writer. I've never planned on writing a book before, but it was at a World Vision conference about 2 years ago. I gave a talk and shared my story. And as I got off the stage, I had several people come up asking me if I've ever thought about writing a book. I said, no, I never thought about writing a book. I'm not a writer. I'm busy being a doctor. But before I knew it, several phone calls were made, and I was paired up with Tim Downs, who's a very talented author. And before you know it, a book has been written.
That's great. We just have a couple minutes left now. Any other, maybe one story about something you've seen as you've been on a board of World Vision, or just in your travels, Vin, that kind of brings your passion to the fore through, you know, opportunity?
Yeah. So I have many passions, and World Vision works out of about 100 countries across the world. And one of the amazing things is that they work with the local people there. And so, for example, the work that I'm sponsoring in Cambodia to help fight sex trafficking is being performed by the local Cambodians. And I think that model, to me, is a very effective way to do it. The one other thing that I'm really passionate about is clean water, which is we're doing a lot of that in Africa, to just provide people just clean water so that they don't have to walk 6 to 8 hours a day, miss school, to get water that's dirty, and then and to suffer so much. And what I'm really passionate about at World Vision is just the expertise that we have arrived at with fighting poverty. As Rich Stearns often says, fighting poverty is rocket science. It's very, very complex. But I believe that we are an organization that is large enough and with sufficient experience to where we could provide clean water for an individual for the rest of their lives for just $50. And so to me, you know, I think about some of the programs we have here in the U.S., and we wonder, is it good, is it bad? But when I think about what people are suffering from overseas, all the preventable causes of death and suffering, for $50, it's really an amazing opportunity to help others.
Give us, finally, some direction. Is there a contact, an email address, or somewhere we should go if we want to help others the way you're doing through World Vision?
Yes. So the best way is to go to worldvision.org, and from there you could be directed to different opportunities to help. There's a child sponsorship program, and then, you know, there are also different projects that you could find on the website. And then, of course, all of the royalties that I have is being donated to World Vision, because I feel that I've been blessed with so much, and this story, which I hadn't even planned on writing, just came about, really. I think God had a hand in it and brought the right people together so that we can have this book. And so anything that I can do to help the work of World Vision, I feel so privileged to be doing.
This has been Vin Chung. He's author of the book Where the Wind Leads. I encourage you to read the book. And Vin, thank you for giving us of your time. As we often feel like our lives are turned upside down, you help us to see that God can make it right again, and we can help others who find their lives have been turned upside down. Thank you for being with us.
Bill, thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
This has been Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell. And Beyond Words is a ministry of Scripture Awakening. Visit us on our website at scriptureawakening.com, where you can download free podcasts of all Beyond Words programs.